Welcome to Creepy Kentucky. I'm Quinn.
And I'm Laura. And is there anything that we would like to discuss before we jump back into our bluegrass conspiracy love-a-thon there?
I got nothing.
No. Oh, if you hear me eating, it's because I'm addicted to peanuts. I'm really sorry, everybody.
It's all good.
It's not. It's so not.
Hey, there are worse things you could be addicted to.
Yeah, everything else I'm addicted to.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, if you hear any noises on my end, Atticus is in here with me today. So.
All right, you have a co-host.
I do.
We have a guest host. Oh. He's our canine advisor.
He is quite wise.
He is. He's a smarty pants.
He is. Atticus for president.
Yeah, okay. I mean, he is considerably younger than most of the candidates we have. So, you know, there is that.
And he could be smarter than both the candidates.
Well, at least one of them.
What you think? But, anyway. Anywho.
Yeah.
So, previously on the Bluegrass Conspiracy, our buddy Ralph Ross had been arrested and was needing a lawyer for that whole, you know, listening in on people.
Yeah.
Wiretapping and...
Yeah, well, you know.
You know, all that fun stuff.
You do what you gotta do sometimes.
Right. Some days after his arrest, the grand jury returned with an indictment.
Okay.
He was indicted on 28 felonies.
Wow. Holy crap. Okay.
Yeah. One was installing the eavesdropping equipment, and the rest were just for eavesdropping.
Okay. Well.
If he was convicted, he could potentially get life in prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Prosecutor told him if he gave up Neil Welch, he would walk away. Basically, they wanted Ralph to say that all the eavesdropping was because Welch told him to do it.
Okay.
Even stranger was the fact that Welch was acting like he didn't know Ross, and he cut off all contact with him.
Uh-huh.
But Ralph knew the real target was Welch of this whole investigation thing.
Huh.
But also, Campbell had been the one to tell Ralph to take surveillance back over in the first place. And had also been the one to put Terry Barnes in special operations. Most, if not all, of what Ralph was learning about the situation was from the papers. He read that Welch requested the FBI to come into the investigation, which Ralph thought was Welch trying to help him from behind the scenes.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Since Ralph could probably get a fair trial in federal courts.
Right. Yeah.
But Commonwealth attorney Larry Roberts, fucking Larry, fought to keep the case.
I'm sure he did.
Which he did. He got to keep the case.
He certainly wasn't like a publicity hound or anything like that.
No, not at all. But the FBI found the charges were groundless, and the U.S. attorney didn't want to prosecute.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the summer of 82, Ralph realized he was not going to be able to get a good lawyer, since every major law firm in Lexington had its ties to either the Vances, the Thorntons, the Kellys, or Jimmy Lambert.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. To add to his stress, he was looking at a $50,000 cost for a lawyer.
Oh, yeah.
The state police has a fund to help officers with legal troubles. But he was hearing whispers that they were going to deny him using that fund.
Hmm.
But finally, Bill Johnson of Frankfort took the case.
Okay.
Ralph was mildly concerned with the fact that Bill had a close friendship with Commissioner Campbell.
Yeah.
And the fact that he had also defended people Ralph had arrested.
Okay. Well, you know.
Just a little concerning.
You know.
The first thing Bill suggested was that Ralph take the plea deal to have all 28 charges dropped. Ralph said, quote, "Hell no, let's go fight this out in the courthouse," end quote. Leading up to the trial, Governor Brown made no comment about the tapes, but did order Welch, Powers, and Campbell to submit to lie detector tests.
And what good does that do? Since they're inadmissible in court, right?
Right. I guess he just wanted to know.
Yeah, just for S&Gs, you know.
Yeah. Both Welch and Campbell said they passed their tests, and Powers refused, which is the smart choice.
Yeah.
But the results were never released for Welch and Campbell, so we don't know if they passed or not. In early December of 82, Ralph was at Breakers and saw good old Act Two.
Yeah.
Woo. Jump out of his chair and head outside.
Not the last time he's going to jump somewhere.
No. Then Ralph realized who he was drinking with.
Ooh.
He had been drinking with Henry Vance.
Nice.
And Jimmy Lambert.
Okay.
Yeah.
Party.
Drew reappeared in the stool beside Ralph and started a conversation with the pickup line, "How you doing?"
Hey, Joey Tribbiani. How you doing? How you doing?
Drew told him at one point in the conversation, quote, "I do hope you don't have to spend any time in the can. It's not a good place for a cop to be." Ralph then asked how Drew spent his time in prison. And Drew responded, quote, "Mostly trying to keep in shape. I read a lot of books and worked out all the time. I ran, lifted weights, did my Tai Chi. It was a long 4 months."
God damn.
Sounds like a vacation, though.
Making it sound pretty damn good there, Andrew. You've sold me.
Yeah, I'm right. I want to go to prison. Dang.
I assume it was federal. It was federal prison then, right?
Yeah, it must have been. It sounds pretty gravy.
Yep.
Drew ended this conversation by saying, quote, "Like I said, I hope you don't have to pull any time, but I hope you get your ass sued," end quote. And this would be the last time the two men would speak to each other.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
At the trial, the people testifying on the prosecution side were Henry Vance, Drew Thornton, John Bizak, and Terry Barnes.
Oh, just a roll call of the best and brightest.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A grand total of 64 people had been subpoenaed to testify. Governor Brown asked if he could testify via deposition, not in person. But the judge ruled that it was in Brown's best interest that he testify in person.
Aw.
Get your ass here. Pretty much.
Yeah.
What I'm hearing from that.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the trial, defense painted a picture of Ralph that he was an officer framed by a disgruntled employee. The prosecution said that Ralph was overzealous, a cop who did what he wanted and stomped all over the civil liberties of whoever he was targeting. So there were 27 conversations that were called into question. Oddly enough, none of those reflected Vance's involvement in drugs or murder.
Weird, huh?
Weird, right?
Yeah, bizarre. That's really bizarre.
It is bizarre. It also made Ralph think that they were picked for that exact reason.
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. Larry Roberts, the prosecutor.
Yeah.
Of course, use this to point out that... Is that a thing? I can't tell what that letter is, but I think it's a thing. Wasn't involved at all, and was just a victim of Ralph. On the second day of the trial, the prosecution noted that the evidence had been handled properly, so there wasn't a chance of evidence tampering. Cross-examination noted that there were other places Vance's conversations could have been recorded, and wondered why the tapes weren't tested or checked for prints.
Mm-hmm.
Barnes went on the stand on day 4. He said that while he didn't like Ralph, he didn't frame him. And okay. You know, he swore on the Bible, so he's telling the truth.
Of course
there.
He is, yeah.
Vance begged the court to play 4 of the conversations. Not to play 2 of the conversations.
Yeah, I bet.
2 between his wife and her sister about Vance's daughter.
I mean,
and 1 was about a domestic happening with his sister-in-law.
Okay.
And the 4th was between Vance and a coworker about a different coworker's job performance.
Oh. Okay. Well, okay.
The judge ruled to play all 27 conversations.
Oh my God. Okay. Oh my God. Well, okay.
Yep. Only 2 of them indicated that Vance was involved with the company. And though they were long distance calls with, surprise, surprise, Drew.
What a shock.
In 1 of these conversations, Drew was whining about a report from federal probation officers. It mentioned Drew and Vance's relationship. Drew asked Vance how things were, and Vance replied, quote, "There's been more crap in the paper. Stuff I'll talk to you about later. The kind of crap you'd expect." End quote. The 2nd call, Drew asked Vance to call back on a different phone. On day 5 of the trial, a 14-minute conversation between Betty G and her lawyer was played. It was recorded with Betty's consent and linked Vance directly to the assassination.
Yeah.
At the start, the lawyer asked her to sign a statement that Vance hadn't given Bonnie the gun. She refused to sign and said, quote, "I know for a fact that Vance gave Bonnie the gun." The lawyer asked, "The gun or a gun?" And she replied, quote, "The gun that was used to kill the guy."
Okay.
Vance was really involved in it all.
Okay. You know.
You know.
You know. As you do. Oh my God.
After the tape, Ralph was sure the jury could be convinced of his innocence.
Mm.
On day 7, he took the stand for 3.5 hours.
Oof.
Yeah. After which, Ralph's attorney said he would rest his case without the dozen or so character witnesses in Ralph's defense. And Ralph wished he would have trusted his gut. The jury deliberated for 3 days.
Holy crap.
It was midnight 1 week before Christmas when they handed down their ruling. And they ruled that Ralph was guilty on 14 counts of illegal eavesdropping. And not guilty on installing the wiretapping equipment and the other 10 charges. 3 of the charges were dropped. The jury recommended a minimum 1 year in prison per charge, so 14 years.
Yeah.
His sentencing date was set for after New Year's. In early January, Ralph's daughter set up a birthday party for his 50th birthday. She invited friends from the FBI.
Happiest of birthdays there, Ralphie.
Yeah. She invited his friends from the FBI, the state police, and the U.S. Attorney's Office. And the only people who came were his friends from high school, members of his surveillance team, his family, and some informants. Betty G came to his birthday party.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But no one from the FBI or the state police or the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Oh,
checked.
Hell no.
He was sentenced on January 28th, 1982. The judge said, for delivering the sentence, that he had never, in all of his years, gotten so much mail asking for leniency. There was also a petition with 2,800 signatures.
Wow.
He was sentenced to 1 year of unsupervised probation.
Holy God.
Which is, yeah. That's
yeah.
It.
That's it?
Yep.
Oh my God. I was going to be like, 1 year in prison, that's pretty good. 1 year of unsupervised probation. Oh my God.
Yep. Ralph, on the other hand, was mad at himself for not looking into Barnes's background. Because if he had, he would know that Barnes had worked the streets of Lexington with Vance Thornton.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Kanan.
Yeah.
In the 70s. He had been accused of selling drugs by undercover informants.
Yeah.
So Barnes wasn't the guy he thought he was. Months after the trial, one of the jurors approached Ralph and said, quote, "You know, the people on the jury wanted to turn you loose. In fact, we were all going to, except for one person. That's why we kept sending notes to the judge asking if he'd go easy on you. Because this guy insisted that if we didn't convict you, that he'd see to it that we had a hung jury, which would mean the next jury would really sock it to you."
And who was this one person?
They never said.
Oh, really?
There was this one person on the jury.
Because it sounds like maybe a little bit of jury tampering going on, maybe.
Yeah, it does sound like that. That's exactly what it sounds like to me. Now, Ralph had an informant.
Right.
Inside Jimmy Lambert's house.
Really?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
She was a 35-year-old housekeeper from Canada named Diana Hall.
Oh, Canada.
Yes. Diana had given Ralph names and phone numbers of people in Lambert's address book, including Randy Burke of the Baltimore Colts.
Oh.
And Sonny Collins of the Atlanta Falcons.
Yeah. Okay.
Again, were the two phone numbers that when called, told the caller if the phone was tapped.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, those phone numbers were also found in Bradley's
right.
and Drew's address books.
Right, yeah.
Diana also had insight into Jimmy's daily life. So, she said that he normally snorted coke with his morning coffee.
I mean, who
which
doesn't?
Which is the best way to start the day,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Who doesn't?
Coke and coffee, the way to go.
Coke and coffee.
He had Coke and Quaaludes.
Okay.
Just staples around the house, so they were always there.
Well,
He had a drug lab in the basement.
Of course he does.
With football-sized packs of pure, unprocessed cocaine. He once threw up and dry heaved for 3 days straight from snorting coke, then taking Quaaludes to mellow out.
Okay. Well, you know.
Maybe not do the coke then?
Yeah.
If you're going to take another drug to mellow out from the first drug that she took.
Yeah.
She transported coke in thermos bottles. Some kind of Stanley joke. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, basic white bitch walking around with.
Yeah.
Some cocaine in her Stanley.
Yeah.
There's lead in Stanley, so what I mean with a little bit of cocaine.
Yeah. One of the people I work with loves those.
Oh my god! Everyone at my work does. I work with a lot of nurses and. I have a HydroFlow cup that I really like.
What's that?
It's pretty much like another version of a Stanley.
Oh, okay.
But the other day, I put ice in it at like 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And the next day at 7 o'clock, it still had ice in it.
God damn.
Granted, it had been stored in the fridge, but still, the fridge isn't usually cold enough to keep ice from melting.
Yeah.
Okay, anyways, Jimmy Lambert, he also hosted parties that were attended by mobsters, legal mobsters, a.k.a. politicians.
Yeah.
Playboy bunnies and businessmen.
Well, yeah, that's the basis of all good party.
That's right. He had daily conversations about cocaine. He had trays of cocaine set out all around the house for guests.
What the good host does. Oh my god. You know.
A coffee bar or a charcuterie.
A co-cutery. Oh my god.
I think we have our episode title.
Yeah. We do. This one I don't have to search for like a week. Yeah, baby.
And he also had a large stash of weapons.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean.
Obviously. Diana was helping both Ralph for the money, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely.
But also to help Jimmy. She was worried that he, unless he was arrested, that he would overdose.
Aww.
And so, 'cause she had come to really, like, care about him.
Okay.
But nothing personal.
Okay. Nothing personal, but he does not sound like that good of a person.
No, he doesn't.
Like, honestly, like, why?
Yeah, he took good care of her, too, though.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not.
Get it wrong. Yeah. She was well taken care of, being his housekeeper.
Yeah, well, that's nice.
Right.
That's
but nice. What concerned her the most is what happened to his escorts.
Oh.
He wasn't a good influence on the young women, and, you know.
Well, no.
So thanks to Diana, Ralph knew as much about the case, or more than the case, as the FBI.
Huh.
Yeah. He knew when they were placing eavesdropping devices in Jimmy's house.
Hmm.
As well as a wiretapping device.
Okay.
He knew when the bugs were put in his living room. Huh. In Jimmy's living room, bedroom, and basement.
Hmm.
He knew when Jimmy got suspicious and had Diana sweep for bugs. He knew they were listening in when Diana told Jimmy that the house was clear. He also wasn't surprised when the conversations between Jimmy and John Y. Brown Jr. ended up being recorded.
Mm.
Now, fast forward to April 11th, 1983.
Okay. All right.
Lexington CBS station aired a tape recorded conversation between former Transportation Secretary Frank Metz and Bill May, a Frankfurt engineer.
Okay.
May said during the conversation that he had donated $23,000 to the Brown campaign and was assured future state highway contracts.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, baby.
Right. So, following the airing, Brown fired Welch and also said he didn't know anything about the taping
of course
until they played it on TV.
Of course not.
Welch, on the other hand.
Oh, dear.
Told reporters Brown had known about it for 16 months.
Yeah.
Then suddenly, strangely.
Yeah. Weird.
Brown remembered that he actually did know about it.
Weird, huh?
Yeah. A week later, FBI raided Brown's BFF, Jimmy Lambert's house.
Yeah.
The report said Jimmy was the subject of their investigation on prostitution, narcotics, corruption, extortion, and murder.
Murder.
Since 1979.
Okay.
It also had investigation on Jimmy's refusal to take a polygraph at the beginning of the Rebecca Moore case.
Okay.
Jimmy was in Europe at the time, but would almost certainly be indicted. After this, Brown went to WKYT for the press conference. And said, quote, "I think what has happened in Lexington makes the movie Absence of Malice look like puffball." The Absence of Malice was the 1981 film starring Paul Newman and Sally Field.
Right. I was going to say, that's what a dated reference.
So I also have what the synopsis is for our young folks, because I didn't really even know. Megan Carter is a reporter duped into running an untrue story on Michael Gallagher, a suspected racketeer. She has an alibi for the time his suspected crime was committed, but it involves an innocent party. When she tells Carter the truth and the newspaper runs it, tragedy follows, forcing Carter to face up to the responsibilities of her job. When she is confronted by Gallagher, and I couldn't find anything about what the fuck puffball is.
Yeah.
I found puffball popple from a show called Popples, but I don't think that's it.
I don't know. I mean, it's John Y. Brown Jr. It could, it was a word he made up, possibly. You never know.
He seems like a Kentucky Donald Trump.
Well, I'm just going to say this, and anybody can take it how they want it, but he was way smarter. He was smarter. I mean, not a much. Better character, but he was way smarter.
Okay.
But he was also, like, I don't know, his wife seemed nice.
Okay.
Oh.
John Y. Brown Jr. defended Jimmy Lambert and said he never saw Jimmy do anything illegal.
Well, he obviously wasn't at his home.
You know, the computer is all around.
The computer is, he obviously wasn't at his house. I find it difficult to believe that, like, oh, John Y. Brown Jr. is coming. Hide the computeries.
Oh, God, the computeries. All 15 of them. Don't let him in the basement.
With all the other drugs.
All the other drugs, right. Hide the Quaaludes.
Oh my God.
Neither the Lexington Herald Leader nor the Louisville Courier Journal reported much on the raids at Jimmy Lambert's house, other than the fact that it happened. Lexington elites were on Jimmy's side, barring anyone on the governor's side of the investigation, or the government side.
Yeah.
The most exclusive Idle Hour Club.
Well, yeah. Our old pal.
Already had restricted policies.
Right.
Was the first to kind of bar anyone, and all the other clubs followed.
Really?
Right. Most everyone supported Jenny.
Yeah.
And we're calling for him to get an apology.
Good luck.
Jimmy was conveniently still in Italy.
Oh, yeah.
The U.S. Attorney's Office was quiet. Were they caving to the pressure?
Hmm.
Ralph wondered. The Herald Leader published letters from Jamie's supporters. One said, quote, other than defamation of character,
bless you.
Excuse me. Emotional strain on family members, intrusion of privacy, legally or not, possible ruination of political ambitions of a close friend, Governor John Y. Brown Jr., and generally just enraging Jim Lambert and friends, the FBI has accomplished little in its investigation and has created an unfortunate situation.
Okay.
Governor Brown moved from Cave Hill to the governor's mansion in Frankfurt. His wife asked about the driveway dimensions at the White House to make it about the same.
Yeah.
Well,
there was a lot of talk at the time when he was, maybe it was 1980 or 84, but there was a lot of talk that he might be a future presidential candidate. And he went to the Democratic convention and he spoke. And I think his speech fell really flat, and that was one of the things that signaled his ambitions like dying. But yeah, there was talk. Yeah, there was talk that he might be a presidential candidate.
Oh, I'm glad that didn't come to fruition.
Yeah, probably a good thing. Yeah, because yeah. I mean, like he definitely had like a charisma about him. In a way that, like, it kind of in a way that, like, a Kennedy had, but he didn't have, at the time, like, the only Kennedy that was running for office was Ted Kennedy. And, of course, he had Chappaquiddick behind him. So,
right.
Yeah, he was kind of, like, really damaged goods. And John Y. Brown Jr., although he did come from, a kind of a lower level political dynasty, he didn't have that kind of baggage yet, you know.
Right.
But yeah.
All right.
Yeah. As an old person, I can.
You just got the knowledge.
Yeah. Well, no, I just have the age.
Jimmy was indicted in Lexington by a federal grand jury.
Cool.
On 59 counts of possession and distribution of cocaine, marijuana, or methaqualone. One count of conspiracy to distribute cocaine.
Wow.
One count violating federal firearms laws. And on June 7th, 1984, Jimmy pled guilty to one drug conspiracy charge as part of a plea deal. And the other 58 charges were dropped.
Jesus Christ.
Fast forward again to March 20th, 1984.
Okay.
Former regional head of the DEA, Harold Brown's estranged wife called C. Fred Parton, who was a former federal prosecutor, with something she should have probably called the cops for first.
Okay.
She had been on the phone with Harold Brown and heard a gunshot on the other line.
Whoa, okay.
So, Parton went to Harold's apartment, again, instead of calling the police.
Yeah.
And he claimed to find all the doors and windows locked from the inside.
Okay.
Inside, Brown lay dead from a single gunshot wound to the head. Parton told reporters the death was a suicide, since Brown had left 3 suicide notes.
Whoa, okay. Well, you know.
You know.
Yeah.
Captain James Black didn't believe it, and he questioned Parton's motives. He was friends with Harold Brown, Drew Thornton, and Bill Canam, and Henry Vance, going back to the early 70s.
Wow.
Before his death, Brown was about to be arrested for manufacturing and distributing poisons.
What?
Specifically ricin.
Oh my God.
Which comes from a protein and the castor bean.
Yeah. Also, it's what killed all those people on that Japanese subway.
Like, yeah.
In like the 80s or 90s, whenever it was. Holy God.
Yeah, it's a bad poison.
Yeah. Yeah. Jesus Christ. And that was somebody here. Oh my God. What the actual fuck?
The story is crazy. I told you. When Black got into Brown's cabin, the guns and files Black thought were important were gone. But the drug lab was still there. In the search, they found ether, nicotine, sodium, ammonium nitrate, tear gas, jeez, and explosives.
Oh, God.
In the lab, they made P2P, which was sold as cocaine and could be bought legally if you had a DEA registration number.
Oh, wow.
And they also found things at the cabin that made police think Brown was also selling mescaline.
Oh, okay.
Which was a hallucinogenic from a Mexican cactus.
Yeah, wow.
Brown founded Dead Horse Hollow Publications, which published booklets on drug smuggling without being detected by the DEA. Okay,
well, you know. As you do.
As you do. Brown's diary showed he had meetings with Drew in the weeks before his death. He also found notes that showed his desire to kill Ralph Ross, Don Powers, Jim Black, and Mike Griffin. The coroner decided there was enough to warrant inquest into his death. An unidentified person drove off in his car hours before the body was discovered.
Mm.
And then brought it back to its spot in the morning.
Oh.
Money had been taken from the apartment after his death. Tape recordings had also been taken that contained conversations relating to his drug deals. But the death was ultimately ruled a suicide.
Okay.
Also in the cabin, they found DEA documents that alluded to a CIA team within the DEA. There were hundreds of pages that detailed the arrangements between the CIA and the DEA that allowed large narcotic sales to get info on Latin American countries. While reading, Ralph plugged in the names of our big players like Mad Libs and tried to fill in the blanks and started to wonder if there actually was, this was true, and if it was why Drew had all the info that he had. Hmm. Why Bradley said he was part of a CIA operation.
Hmm.
Why,
hmm,
to all of Ralph's questions.
Hmm.
At least about Drew and Bradley.
Right.
But he didn't think the CIA would trust Drew and Harold Brown.
And
ultimately decided that no, Drew was not working for the CIA. All right. Now we're going to fast forward to September 11th, 1985.
Oh my God. Here we go.
Here we go.
Here we go. Here we go.
Important parts have all led to this. Ralph got a call that Drew Thornton was dead. Dun, dun, dun. He had been found by Fred Myers in his driveway in Tennessee. He was wearing night vision goggles, a money belt with $4,500, a bulletproof vest, Gucci shoes, and combat fatigues. In his wallet were found a membership card for the Lexington Fraternal Order of Police.
Of course.
And IDs with the name, with Andrew Thornton and Andrew Bourbon.
Okay.
That's, like, real clever, isn't it?
Yeah.
He was laying face down arms over his head, and holding the ripcord of a partially deployed reserve chute in his right hand.
Oh, God.
Under his knees was a 3.5-foot-long duffel bag with 75 pounds of unprocessed cocaine. The autopsy report read, quote, "Body is that of a very well-developed, muscular, well-nourished adult white male."
Mm-hmm.
The medical examiner created a scenario. Quote, "The victim jumped from the aircraft and opened his main chute. Before an unknown reason, got a streamer. By this time, he was at terminal velocity and did a cross-hand release of the reserve chute, which destabilized him in a head-down position."
Oh, shit.
"The abrupt deceleration by the emergency chute from 120 miles per hour to 40 miles per hour in 4 seconds decelerated the victim, but not the bag attached to his waist belt."
Oh.
"This bag then struck him, inflicting the abrasions on the neck and chin and fractured teeth, which produced at least semi-consciousness. Because of this semi-consciousness state, he did not release the brakes on the reserve chute, which caused oscillation, during one of which the leading edge of the chute stalled, allowing him to essentially free fall for an unknown number of feet."
Wow.
End quote.
Wow.
It did not mention the fact that Drew could have been hit before exiting the plane, like the FBI suggested to Ralph.
Yeah.
Parachute experts were called to the scene and couldn't figure out if the main chute had malfunctioned or if Drew had simply not opened it. It was determined that Ralph was hit with part of the plane when he jumped out, was knocked out, and dying as he plummeted to the ground.
Right.
The reserve chute was opened as a reflex, and it couldn't handle his weight plus all of the cocaine. His deceleration
just
caused
let go
his
of the goddamn
rupture.
Cocaine. Oh my god.
He landed on his heels first, then fell back. Fell forward, it would be.
Yeah.
He also had a habit of pulling his ripcord well under the 2,000 feet minimum, and he may have done this to avoid customs this time.
Well, yeah, sounds like it. Maybe.
Ralph didn't think Drew had intended to jump, but something made him change his plans. Leading up to that night, Ralph learned that Drew had a habit of doing more than a gram of coke a day, which made him more paranoid than usual.
Jeez, yeah.
She had started fanatically preparing for the impending race sports.
Ah,
I guess okay. He took Manson to heart.
Oh my god.
And yep. Armageddon.
Of course.
Uh-huh.
Man.
Drew had majorly screwed up a few months earlier when he dropped a load of cocaine on the wrong side of the Bahamas.
Uh-oh. Rot-row.
The Colombians were not pleased.
No.
So the question on Ralph's mind was who was chasing Drew to make him jump? Customs or Colombians? The world will never know.
Yeah.
60 miles from Knoxville, a plane was discovered. Two fishermen saw the crash at about 1 a.m. It had been put on autopilot and ran out of gas, so it didn't burn when it landed. The identifying number matched the key in Drew's pocket. All of the seatbelts were fastened, except for the pilot and co-pilot seats, which meant someone else had been on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
But what was most interesting, and stayed with Ralph for years, was a briefcase with a hit list that included three names: Ralph Ross, James Black, and Bud Farmer. Police found some poisons in Drew's apartment, as in Harold Brown's place. On September 14th, 22 U.S. service workers in northern Georgia found three black nylon duffel bags hanging from a parachute in a tree. Inside was 150 pounds of cocaine. That same afternoon, more duffel bags of cocaine were found in the Chattahoochee National Forest. In his will, Drew left much to Harold, or to Vance, and ended with, quote, "There is to be no funeral. After usable body parts, eyes, kidneys, etc., are removed, I want to be cremated. Release my ashes over my parents' farm and have a party." End quote. Which, honestly, sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. I'll give him that.
Yeah. On December 22nd, 1985, a 175-pound black bear was found in Blue Ridge, Georgia, dead of an overdose. It had gone into a duffel bag with 75 pounds of cocaine. It's the basis of the movie Cocaine Bear.
Yeah.
And lives at the Kentucky for Kentucky Mall.
Yeah.
I've actually seen him.
Yeah.
So this is a quote that I found. Yeah. From the KentuckyForKentucky.com
blog. Yeah.
Quote, "That's a lot of the old booger sugar, even for a bear." Can you imagine? One minute he's trying to find enough berries to survive another boring day in the Chattahoochee. The next minute he's ripping fat rails of Colombian disco dust off of tree stumps and water skiing in jeans with Alan Jackson, forcing all the other bears to listen to Huey Lewis in the news before chopping off their heads with an axe.
Probably playing a lot of Van Halen, too.
Probably. I think the Huey Lewis in the news thing is a American Psycho reference.
Yeah. I wouldn't know.
Of course, the poor thing did none of that.
No.
It died from the overdose within 45 minutes.
Aw, bear. Poor bear.
On January 1987, Vance was indicted by a federal grand jury in the murder conspiracy of Eugene Berry 4 days before the statute of limitations expired. Vance was convicted on the 29th of October, 1987, and sentenced to 15 years in federal penitentiary.
I mean, in all honesty, got off pretty light.
He did. And that's the end. That's all we have in the book. We have made it.
That was awesome.
Thank you.
I mean, God, what a mess.
It's for real.
Like, ugh. And I will say, it says a lot about Lexington that Larry Roberts just continued his career, you know?
Yeah.
His grandstanding career. Like, basically prosecuting innocent people and presumably defending crooks.
Right.
And then made a career out of being, you know, like being hard on criminals. I'm like, not hard enough.
Clearly not.
Yeah. Well, it is what it is.
Right.
Well. Wow.
Did you ask? I think we can. What the hell, Larry Roberts said?
Yeah.
Oh, after we have an email.
What about Lambert?
What about Lambert too?
No, Joe's asking me a question.
Oh.
Hold on.
About John Lambert, who's Chief Justice in the Supreme Court.
Kentucky. What about him?
If he's related to
that. Oh, is he related to Jimmy Lambert? Oh, that's a good question. I didn't even think of that. John Lambert was the Chief Justice of the Kentucky Supreme Court.
Oh.
So was he related to Jimmy Lambert? Maybe that, you know. I don't know. That would explain some things.
Yeah.
Have to do.
I'm Googling it real quick.
Yeah.
Yep. No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
But it would explain some things.
That we know of.
Yeah, right.
That's what I heard. I don't know. I'm going to try. I need to do a Ghostbusters reference every single time. And I never remember.
Try to work it in.
Yeah. Cool. All right.
Okay.
Oh, our email. Well,
yeah, we have an email. It's creepykentucky@gmail.com.
Woo!
And we have a Twitter.
And an Instagram.
And those are both at Creepy Kentucky.
Woohoo.
And we were going to What the Hell, Larry Roberts?
Larry Roberts, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And 3, 2, 1.
Larry Roberts. What the
hell? Ah, we did it!
Yeah.